Hello, everyone. Welcome to the fourth episode of the High Performance Arsenal, a podcast where we explore skills and techniques that help you harness the power of the mind and body to become high performers. Whether it's on the field or right before a big interview, the things I discuss on this podcast will apply to you if you want to reach your full potential. The point of discussion today is self-talk. I sat down with Dr. Andrew Vincent, a New York-based psychologist who specializes in both psychotherapy and sports psychology. He started his practice to help people connect with their best qualities and trust themselves so that they can begin to live the life they want to instead of the life that they are supposed to. We discuss what self-talk is, and not only how it affects our mood and emotions, but also how it can impact our performance. We also spend a good part of the podcast laying out a step-by-step process on how we can improve our self-talk and improve performance. If you struggle with a really loud inner critic or just have a really negative inner voice, you won't want to miss this episode. So, without further ado, here is my discussion with Dr. Andrew Vincent.
Relevant to the topic that we're discussing today, which is self-talk, is just to talk a little bit about my introduction to Dr. Andrew. My master's thesis is in self-talk, and one of the first papers I ran into was written by Dr. Andrew, Dr. Van Ralt, and Dr. Brewer, and it was in the Journal of Sport and Exercise Psychology, and it was titled, it was in 2016 titled Self-Talk Review and Sports-Specific Model, and it shaped a lot of what we're going to talk about today and a lot of what I do now with my work with athletes as well. So that's how I got introduced to his work, and then at a conference, I had the awesome pleasure to get introduced to him, and then since then, we met up almost once a month to discuss self-talk, cool things that we read online or seen related to it, and it's going to be a fun opportunity to talk to you guys about what self-talk is and how you can use it to enhance your performance. So without further ado, here is Dr. Andrew, and I hope you guys enjoy the conversation. Dr. Andrew, how are you doing?
I'm great, Grant. How are you? I'm honored to be episode four. I see it right on the screen here. That's a good number to be.
It really is. It's a good lucky number, and I'm doing great, and I'm so excited to jump right into the conversation.
Now, thank you first for that really nice introduction. Like, I'm honored to have been a part of shaping your thinking, and I'm happy that you know what journal that paper was in, because at this point, I wouldn't be able to tell you. But yeah, like, I'm just happy someone read it.
Heck yeah. And I think that's one of the best things, like, as I'm writing my thesis too, it's like, I hope someone reads this and gets something like a light bulb moment. And that's really what that paper was for me. Because I think for a long time, when I think about self-talk, I've noticed that inner voice inside my head. And I always wondered, like, what the heck is it? Like, is it me? Who is that voice? What is it? Why is it hurting me sometimes, helping me other times? And it's really cool how it's tied to performance. But I think before we jump into all the tools that you can use with self-talk, it's good to have a base understanding of what self-talk really is, because when I talk to my athletes, a lot of what I hear is like, oh, it's that person in my head, or it's that subconscious, or it's positive self-talk or negative. But what exactly is self-talk?
Yeah, so, you know, I think like we could go with like this sort of academic definition, which I don't know if I could tell you exactly how we defined it in that paper. But, you know, one of the big things we were looking for academically was it's a version of intrapersonal communication. So like kind of communication with yourself that takes place through words and sentences and sounds, I guess. And so we wanted to shape it separated from maybe, you know, we can communicate through ourselves with images, or we can communicate through ourselves even with gestures or something. Like, you could give yourself the finger, give yourself a thumbs up or whatever. And that might be some form of self-communication, but isn't necessarily self-talk. So I think we landed on, you know, communication with a sender of the message is also the receiver, and it's syntactically recognizable, which is kind of like a fancy way of saying like what I said before, which is that it's in words and sentences. I probably, like, in conversations since then, Dr. Van Ralt and I have dropped that idea of syntactically recognizable, like probably just the things you say to yourself that happen in words and sentences. But I think for most of us, really, just to be able to say it's the things that we say to ourselves and the things that we kind of hear going on in our head, you know, whether that's sometimes that might come very strongly in the form of a voice, sometimes it might be a little bit more fragmented, sometimes, you know, it's not always, you know, this very clear, hey, you can do it, although that counts. Sometimes it might be our immediate reaction to something, too, like, you blew it, or wow, you're awful today, or whatever, like those some spontaneous things too also count as self-talk.
Yeah. So what I'm understanding is self-talk is essentially any time you're speaking with yourself, and that could be through body language, gestures, but also through words. And those words can either be like planned, or it's where you're calculating what's happening and you're thinking it through in your head. But it could also mm-hmm. be just like an emotional reaction to something.
Yep. Yeah. Like the self-talk is anytime that's going to pop up in your head in words. So okay. Like the thumbs up to yourself or the gestures, those are probably some version of self-communication.
Mm-hmm.
For 99% of people, it doesn't matter whether we call that like a self-gesture or self-talk. Yeah. I think like academically in that paper, maybe it did. Like we wanted to separate that out. But I think for our conversation today, like, yeah, like we're talking about communication with yourself, and specifically when that has some kind of language component to it.
Got it. So it's those conversations with ourselves. I'm curious, so what is the role of self-talk? I remember when I was growing up, and like it would always, like whenever I'd have anxiety or some going into some situation and I was nervous, that voice would more often not get in the way. And I'd wonder, it's like, is this got to be a defect, right? Like I'm screwed up in some way. We're like, why is this voice here? So I'm curious, like maybe some people are thinking this, is this like a defect of the human mind? Or is this something that, what really is the role of talk? Yeah.
I mean, good news, Karan, you're not defective in any sort of way. So that's, we can take that off the board. I mean, in terms of its purpose, probably there's an extent to which we still have something to learn about that. Mm-hmm. You know, the research, like some of the things we do know, it can serve a self-regulatory function. You know, we also know that kids, when they're learning early on in their lives, will talk to themselves gradually as they're learning tasks. So it might be more typical for 3-year-old, 5-year-old. I can't remember the exact, it's like Vygotsky's internal language development or something like that. I can't remember the exact ages, but like, you know, that speech kind of goes from outer speech to internal speech. And, you know, kind of maybe we're talking ourselves through a task or having a reaction to the world, or, you know, maybe it serves as self-regulating. Sometimes we can tell ourselves to do this or do that. And sport psychology, frequently self-talk is used as an intervention to improve performance, which I'm sure we'll get into at some point more. One of the ways that I kind of think about it more recently is rather than it, the functionality of it or the purpose of it, why is this here, is really like this just seems to be part of human experience. And the range of how much different people experience self-talk is really varied. So I'm someone who does tend to have a lot of language that goes on in my head. Like I do kind of talk to myself. There's internal dialogues and internal conflicts that play out in language, or fake conversations I'm never going to have with someone, right? Like those do play out in that way. What research tells us is that other people have a lot of other kinds of inner experience, whether it's like images or emotions or these just different, there's like five that I can't name all of them off at the top of my head right now, but, you know, some people might not have much internal self-talk at all that occurs verbally. It's, they experience the world in different ways. So you're not defective, but you might have more self-talk than other people. And I suspect that I do as well.
Yeah. It's cool that you mentioned that some people don't, because it was just yesterday when I was doing a workshop on self-talk, when we were discussing like, what are some of the things you say when you felt incredibly confident or not confident? And one of the girls raised her hand and she was like, yeah, but I don't actually have a voice. Like, what's wrong with me? And it threw me off for a second too. I was like, oh boy. But then it reminded me that I have some friends where when we talked about imagery in class, they said when they close their eyes, they can't really visualize anything. Mm-hmm. It doesn't work for them. So it's just, I guess, different wirings for different folks.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And I think it's especially, you know, for anyone listening who's like a practitioner of sports psychology or just interested in some sort of way, it's just important to recognize that, you know, on the practitioner side, so many of our interventions, especially if we're working from like a cognitive behavioral kind of framework, involves sort of telling ourselves certain things or manipulating sort of our thoughts in a certain way. But that doesn't always account for just the diversity in how people experience their own thoughts. And so like you might assume like, oh, like I'm going to do a workshop right now on self-talk. And then it's like someone doesn't really have self-talk and it's like, oh, like what do I do here? And obviously you bumped into that yesterday and that's just something that can happen. We'll do a new one on imagery for her. And hopefully that's something that she experiences and can relate to.
Absolutely. when I was talking to them about self-talk, we were working on connecting it to performance. Mm-hmm. And there's this really good quote, and I may butcher this, but it's kind of like, you sow a thought, you reap an action. So an action, you reap a habit. You sow a habit, you reap a destiny. It's something
cheesy. Like, I'm sorry about that. I thought I had muted myself.
That's okay.
You want to edit that out and go back and start your quote again?
Or do you absolutely let's do that. I mean, it's not the end of the world, honestly. It's like we're just having a conversation. You're blowing your nose. It's okay.
Sorry about that. I really thought I had muted myself.
No, that's okay.
All right.
Yeah, so essentially what I was saying, right? So when we're trying to show, it's like it's not just this voice. It's connected to performance. We try to go through the cascade of events of how it can affect it. And that quote, I think, really shows it well, where it's like what you're saying to yourself or what's being said to you will really affect how you feel and how you behave. And how you behave and how you act is going to define how you perform. And that's also just going to dictate how you do one thing is how you do everything. So if that's how you perform on the field, chances are that's how self-talk might affect you in the rest of your lives. So I kind of want your thought on that. It's like the way that self-talk and the cascade of events that it affects to lead to performance.
Yeah, I think I have split thoughts on that. And so, like, you know, we can kind of talk through both lines of thought. And my first thought is, you know, we certainly know from the sports psychology research literature that self-talk can impact performance, and that talking to ourselves in certain ways and using certain kinds of cue words impacts performance and impacts attention and things like that. And when I'm working with athletes, most of the time, if I'm using cue words or cue phrases, it's to cue attention in a certain way and cue their focus towards certain stimuli or towards like a certain feature of their identity, I guess. Maybe we'll get into this more probably as we talk about like discursive self-talk and inner dialogue and, you know, why I do that. We'll probably get to. So like, yes, definitely it's going to make a difference, and paying attention to it matters. And if you are, you know, constantly berating yourself or being hard on yourself or only focusing on mistakes and not really noticing any successes, that over the long term is going to have an effect on your interaction with the world and the interaction with the game and your relationship with yourself. And, you know, in that case, you know, long-term criticism I would expect to be negative, although different people have different reactions to positive and negative self-talk. And that kind of leads me to like my second line of thought, which is that self-talk is important. We also have to be really careful not to police every thought and phrase that goes through our heads. And so this is something that I sometimes see with athletes, and maybe athletes who have a certain amount of exposure to sports psychology, or maybe just a certain amount of exposure to this idea of positive thinking. And they'll get this idea that like, oh, I can't be negative, or I always have to be positive. And almost like any sort of negative thought or negative reaction or worry or concern is going to affect them and really like overthrow their whole performance. And that's not. And like, I work often with people, like all sorts of things go through our heads, right? And if you were to really track every thought you had as you just walked down the street, you know, you might be walking down the street and you might be like, oh, I like that person's shoes. And like, oh, like that couple is cute together. And oh, what am I having for dinner? And interesting hat. And like, wow, I don't like that shirt. Or like, I don't spend that much time thinking about people's clothes, but I'm just trying to think of like, when you walk down the street, right? But like, you're probably never going to pay attention to any of those thoughts again. Like, I'm going to be like, oh, those are cool shoes. And then I get home and probably if someone's going to be like, hey, you remember that person's shoes? I'm going to be like, no, like, I have no idea what you're talking about, right? Like a lot of the thoughts we have through our day have almost no sticking power. And that can be true in sport too. Sometimes with things like worries or concerns, you might have this, wow, what if I play really badly tonight and I blow the entire game and we lose and that's it for our season, right? Like that would be horrible, but like that thought doesn't need to be any more significant or effective than, hey, look at that person's shoes, right? It's just your brain throwing ideas at you. And so sometimes a thought like that becomes a little stickier because emotionally the prospect of losing a game is more charged and creates worry. And so we feel like, uh-oh, like we got to fix that. But that's something often with self-talk that's really important is, you know, how do you strike that balance between paying attention to your self-talk, using it in ways that are helpful for you, but also not trying to police every sentence that goes through your brain and every reaction that you have, because that takes a huge amount of energy. It can be very distracting and might cause you to put undue focus on things that weren't really going to affect you much anyways.
That's fascinating. I like the idea of how whatever voice you hear in that moment doesn't have to be like that important. Like if it's not serving you, it's probably just at the forefront because it's such a sticky thought where it's emotionally charged and it feels really deep. So then that's what forms, I guess, the way you're seeing the situation. During the workshop, when we're discussing what we're going to go into next is like discursive psychology, where I told them there's this idea where like the voice that we have in our head almost paints the reality. So if it's like, wow, I'm going here and this is really going to suck, well, then chances are you're going to start viewing everything under that light. So what you're mentioning is like, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, it's like we have multiple, I guess, versions or voices that go on during many situations, pointing out different things. And just like one voice is really sticky saying that this is sucking, this sucks, like this is not it. There's another voice that might be a little bit more encouraging and we can choose which one to listen to because we determine what we give importance to. Mm-hmm. And it's learning how to take back that control. Am I getting
it? Yeah, you know, certainly we'll get into like the discursive parts of that, or like inner discourse and kind of like the society of the mind is maybe a phrase we'll use. But like, I think maybe just as an entry to that, treating your thoughts like you're being followed around by a group of four-year-olds that are throwing different ideas at you, as compared to having one narrator in your head who is dictating the truth to you, makes a big yeah. difference in how you interact with your thoughts. And so like if you have this one soul voice that is me and it's telling you you might blow this game and you could be terrible, well, I understand what that's scary, right? Like some part of me thinks I'm going to blow this, or maybe I just think I'm going to blow this, maybe I'm not confident. Like that can kind of create like it can affect your narrative or kind of identity. How do I see myself, which is going to have knock-on effects for attention and what am I focusing on? Like you said, you know, someone who's entering the game or entering some sort of performance situation with a lens that's like, wow, I might be terrible, they're going to be more likely to notice mistakes or threats or things that might, you know, it's just what do we foreground and background is loosely related to how we see ourselves and the narrative that we've composed for ourselves. And so, you know, being mindful of that's important. And then being able to recognize that, you know, our thoughts, first of all, like you said, that there's people rarely feel one way about anything. And if you were really to like let your mind open up and around most things, you probably would notice like I have two or three different reactions to what I think about this. This went well, but then this other part is like, wow, I wish this other part went better. Or like, I wish I had, you know, done this thing better. Or, you know, like, that was the best I could do in some other part, but yeah, but that wasn't really good enough, you know? And so it's like, we sort of do have these different voices and characters. And I think we can get into some different ways of approaching that. But I often encourage the athletes I work with or the people who I'm working with to start thinking of those thoughts as more like four-year-olds because of a few reasons. You know, the first one is I have a four-year-old son who I take seriously, but we don't take everything four-year-olds say terribly seriously, mm-hmm. right? So like, I'm going to listen to him when he's saying something, but if he tells me there's a dragon in the front yard, I'm not going to run to lock the door, right? Like if he tells me the sky is falling, I'm not going to scoop him up and run to the basement. And so like, I think that's important with our self-talk too, is that, you know, if our mind is conjuring the worst possibilities, that being able to recognize and hear those, like, I'm not going to say to my son, like, there's no dragon. How dare you? Right. Like he's playing a game or he's thinking about something fun, or like, maybe he thinks there's a dragon and that's something else I need to deal with. But like, I'm not going to get upset at him for saying that or react strongly. You know, I'm going to treat him sort of with some compassion and understanding and space that he's doing his own thing. And we can treat our thoughts that way too. And it just creates space for how do I want to react next, as opposed to, you know, maybe taking every thought we have very seriously as a reflection of truth. We have a committee of four-year-olds suggesting things in various ways.
Well, I like that committee of four-year-olds. And there's a few thoughts I have about that. The first one is this quote by, I think it's Viktor Frankl. And he said, between a situation and our reaction, there is a space. And within that space is our ability to choose. And I think that's a lot of what you're saying. Because if we think something negative, we don't have to completely let that shape the way we see things. We can react in a different way. And that space is offered to us with the self-awareness of like different voices. What I am curious about is like, is there a reason why oftentimes the negative voice is always the loudest or the one that's picking out the threats? Is there, I don't know, could you speak to, is there an evolutionary reason behind it? Because I have some theories, but I'm curious if there's anything that you've learned that might point to the fact that why do we always look towards the negative? Why is that the stickiest one?
Well, I think two things. Like the first thing I would say is, like, I'm not a student of evolutionary psychology. So I don't know from that framework, and I don't often think from that framework. So I don't, there could be, and like, I just haven't encountered it or don't know the answer there. You know, I think also being mindful of individual differences here too. And I don't know if there's been a study ever that looks at what are the kinds of self-talk people experience with what kinds of frequency, like most. So like even just saying, why is the negative the most sticky or the most common? I'm not 100% sure that it is, or 100% sure that that would be true for everyone across the board. It does seem to have a certain power, like my personal experience and then working with athletes, I think similar to your intuition, like it is the one that we're bumping into the most, maybe in our field of sports psychology, because of what we're doing, it's the one we're bumping into the most, or the one that's most frequently identified as problematic. I think with that, you know, there are probably a couple of things that come to mind. You know, one is our own bias for what's important. You know, and if you think about going through your day, and if at some point a coworker were to compliment you, and then later on in the day, a coworker were to get really frustrated with you or angry at you or, you know, criticize you, or in this case, maybe a boss were to criticize you. The thing that probably hangs out more is the criticism for most of us. And it could be a little bit of that too. Just we tend to weigh criticism and challenge more heavily. Part of that could be the emotional piece, right? The emotions that frequently come with criticism or challenge or, you know, belittling or whatever it is. Like a lot of the times those are hurt and disappointment and embarrassment and guilt. And, you know, those are sticky emotions. And so probably the emotional charge of those makes a difference too. You know, recently I've started getting into, like just recently, like listened to 3/4 of a book, on ebook, a short book about internal family systems. You know, and he talks a lot about, you know, sometimes the role of different voices in our larger inner dialogues. And, you know, he'll talk about like the Rob Schwartz is one of the pioneers of internal family systems. That's the he that I'm referencing here. He talks about managers, like certain voices that are managers. And often these voices are sort of taskmasters or critical or, you know, and his suggestion is that, you know, those often play a really self-protective role in our larger consciousness of, you know, if we're worried about making mistakes, if we want to avoid failure, if we've had past failure, if we've had past humiliation, that these voices that have a strong critical or comparative tone, even though it's negative, that ultimately they're playing this role of trying to sort of protect us moment to moment and stop us from doing things that would be damaging or embarrassing or hurtful or scary, and also keep us in line with, you know, maybe social customs or social norms or whatever, kind of playing that ego role or super ego role of, you know, what's expected of me and how do I be that? And so those are a few suggestions for you or thoughts for you.
That's fascinating. This also conversation reminds me of a TV show. I don't know. Have you heard of Veep?
I have seen like 5 minutes of the first episode, yeah. But my wife and I have a bad habit of like watching 5 minutes of something and being like, no, we're not into that. So that it didn't get past there for us, but I've heard a lot of really good things.
It's a fantastic show. And like, she's essentially, for people listening, she's a vice president, Veep. And I kind of think of politicians in this way, because when she goes from like interview to interview or situation to situation, she has these individuals around her, like her team, her chief of staff, her person who's in charge of communications. And whenever she goes into a situation, she doesn't know what to do. Guys, what am I going to do here? And they all give her suggestions like, oh, this is a soundbite. This is what you say in this interview. And each character around her has a different perspective. One is career focused. The other one's very, you know, he communicates with journalists. So he's very like, all right, we need to be aware of like saying not this, not that, not that. So when I was watching it, a part of me was like, this is kind of like the voices in your head. Like she was going into an interview and the interviewer looked a lot better than she did. She's like, guys, I need to say something to get control of this situation because I don't want people to think about that. And all these advisors gave her different, you know, they're like these four-year-old different voices giving her advice on what to say. And each one has their different focus.
Yeah, I think that's a really nice analogy for this is like we all probably have sort of our own team of, you know, different and like, we'll, you know, we'll use the term voices here or parts is sometimes used or, you know, we have these different internal reactions in our head that kind of are a little bit of a team reacting to the world as we move through. And that like any team or like any group, there's power dynamics that exist there. There's history that exists here. Who's being listened to at certain times. You know, that's often structured and comes from stuff that we've been through and, you know, how we're feeling or what kind of situation it is. It's triggered contextually. So, you know, that's all really important to recognize too, is like our internal team, has its own pecking order a little bit at different times. And probably sometimes that critic might get to the top of there.
Yeah. So what I'm understanding, so since we're, I think, diving nicely into dialogical self-talk or dialogical self, would you mind introducing, I guess, what the theory is, like the dialogical self and how self-talk gets tied in? We've touched on it a little bit already with like saying there's multiple voices, but just to kind of have a clear-cut definition of what it is and what it means with self-talk.
Yeah. So for most of us, probably, we're used to thinking of ourself as like a unitary and singular self. There's us and we're the ones who are up here in our heads and we're the ones who are talking and thinking. And if we make a mistake, we're the ones making that mistake. If we have a bad day, we're the ones who have that bad day. If we have an emotion, it's our emotion, right? And so, but it's just this singular self that kind of is supposed to feel one way about things. And actually this idea has a really long tradition in Western thought. And so, you know, with Rene Descartes, I think, therefore I am, it's this idea that the self is the part of me that thinks and does this thinking. Like Plato, even earlier than that, had this analogy of like the charioteer where the rational mind is controlling the emotions of the horses. Like we often put this part of us that thinks and does the thinking as this primary us. The idea of dialogical consciousness moves away from that, not so much in that, you know, I'm not going to say, hey, I'm four people, like I'm still me, but what it comes up to is that rather than there being some singular us that's doing this thinking, we have sort of these different parts or perspectives or voices that process in different ways and exist in different ways. And so this might be about a position or role that we're occupying at a different time. So like me going out and spending time with my friends, like I as friends might notice and think and process differently than when I'm with my four-year-old son and in this role of I as dad. And so, you know, if one of my friends goes too close to the street, like I'm probably not going to give him a hard time about it. My four-year-old son, if he's wandering too close to the street, like that's something I'm going to notice. And so, you know, that would be one version of these different internal positions is sort of these different roles that pop up. You know, another version might be different people who we've sort of internalized who have been important throughout our lives. And so, you know, for athletes, maybe you have a coach who was really impactful on you, or maybe your parents were really important in your sporting development or really, you know, often gave you feedback. And so, you know, sometimes something pops up and you're like, oh, my coach would have liked I guess, right? Maybe you make a play and you know, oh, I worked on that with that coach, and you think about that coach in your head, be like, yeah, awesome, right? You have this internalized version of that coach or internalized version of that parent who's cheering you on or maybe criticizing or whatever. And so that's another version of what these parts can look like. And then in internal family systems and actually emotion focused therapy to some extent too, they talk about the neurology of this, which is interesting. And I don't have a full grasp of this yet, but there's a neurological basis for this idea as well, which is that often different parts of our brain will kind of start working together in recognizable ways that will do the processing. And so the fight or flight response might be a version of this, right? So if you were to look at a person in a fight or flight response, there's a hormonal response, there's a neurological response, and there's probably that unfolds in some predictable fashion. Let's say in this case, I'm trying to think of the example Rob Schwartz gives in his book, but like, let's say one of your internal parts was the inner critic. What he actually says is that we might expect, similar to a fight or flight response, which has like a recognizable hormonal and neuronal and experiential, what does it feel like in fight or flight? Like there's a pattern here that we can recognize, that you as an individual might have this common pattern of what does it feel like to be your inner critic? What does it feel like when the critic pops up? Such that when this critic is heavily activated, there's probably going to be some sort of recognizable brain structure. There's going to be common emotions that pop up regularly. The things we notice and pay attention to are going to pop up regularly. There's a narrative structure and cognitive schema. So, you know, if I'm in the critic mode, my narrative of self is maybe that I'm not good enough, that I'm not doing things right, that I have to do better, that I have to try harder, that I haven't fixed enough yet, right? That's a way of seeing myself. It's a story of self that's going to organize our experience too. And so it's like, if you take all these and kind of put them together, you know, that can also be how we think of a part, is sort of a certain way our experience is organized at a certain time that changes the way we experience ourselves and change the way we experience the world.
Yeah. That's really fascinating. Because like, you have yourself, and these different voices will shape not just how you speak or think or, you know, have engage in that self-talk. You mentioned there's a neurological aspect to it too. So the way your brain fires, the way hormones are released, whether you're going to fight or flight. And that's actually really, really cool. Because I think as someone who has a very big inner critic, it's kind of comforting to hear. It's like, if I go into a situation and that voice is like, you know, going into a workshop, for example, if I'm like just tearing the workshop apart, even though I feel like it's good, but like, this isn't good enough, just going into it. Now I'm just like dissecting it when I should just really listen to that other voice. That's like, all right, you put in the work, go out and have fun, or like showtime. And it's, creates that distance where it's like, all right, it's just I've actually named it too. And we can talk about, because you mentioned that in our emails, like, how do you work through this? And you said the first step is naming it so you can recognize it. So I call that inner critic Judge Judy. Judging everything I do puts me on the trial. And it's like, all right, this is just Judge Judy doing a normal yapping. She wants me to be perfect, but I won't be, and that's okay. And then it allows me to sort of create that distance and go, all right, what's my inner Ted Lasso saying? All right, he's saying, all right, let's believe and let's just go for it. And mixed results, because sometimes I'm in my head like, oh my God, there's other voices too. But it's nice to kind of have, it's like a little switch. You've likened it to radios in our emails before. And when we've talked, it's like, when you recognize that it does have that volume knob, you can learn to turn it down and turn the other ones up.
Yep. And right, so we've had that conversation before of kind of like voices and volume knobs. And, you know, when you can recognize kind of like, who are these different, you know, different versions, different voices, different parts that pop up at different times, you know, in a certain moment, can you turn down the volume on one and turn up the volume on another? You know, and that can be really helpful, right? Because like having Ted Lasso rather than Judge Judy, like indefinitely, it's going to change what you're paying attention to, right? Like if you're sort of in Ted Lasso mode, you might notice the person who it's clicking with. You might notice the thing you just said. Well, you might be focused on, you know, really connecting with the audience you're presenting to. And, you know, if you're in more of a judgmental mode, you might be looking, well, who are the two or three people who don't feel like I'm connecting to them. And then, oh gosh, I'm not connecting to them. What do I need to do better? And oh no, now I just said this thing wrong. Should I even do this next part? You know, it can get a little bit cascading for sure. Yeah. And so, you know, sometimes it's harder and easier to control. Like sometimes it is, it's amenable to like turning down a volume knob in a certain moment and turning up another one. Sometimes it's like much more difficult to shake that inner critic or the emotions or like, you know, whatever the part is that maybe feels like it's getting in your way, and especially shake the emotional part that's coming with that. And so, yeah, there's different things to do with that at different times, but I like voices and volume knobs, one, because there's like a nice alliteration to it. But I think also it just feels a little bit, like you said, empowering. This isn't just me beating myself up, you know?
Yeah.
That I can dial back a little bit if I choose to, and if it's willing to step aside, and I can, you know, dial up a different part that maybe I would perceive to be more helpful.
Yeah. So I'm curious, as people, I guess the ones that do realize that they do have this inner voice and this inner conversation, the monologue all the time, if they're also realizing like, okay, my voice is also very critical, or maybe it's like overanalyzes everything. And I'm sure everyone has that different dominant voice in negative situations. How can the, like, if we were to put it into like a step-by-step process, like a protocol in a way, what would be the first step that they can take towards improving their self-talk?
Awareness is always the first step, right? So, I mean, at this point, like you've mentioned, this person is already aware that they maybe have this predisposition towards being very critical of themselves, or being hard on themselves. And I think that, you know, the second thing would really be making sure, is that getting in your way? I'm someone who can be pretty harshly critical in moments, but usually in intense but fleeting ways. So like I might make a mistake and internally like really be like, idiot, what was that? But like that's gonna dissipate quick and I can move on from it well. So like if I were working with myself around that, that's not something that I would say, hey, that needs to be addressed. And so I think that would be step one is awareness. Step two is really deciding, is this something important to address? In your example, you've already said yes to both of those. So it's like, yes, it's something that happens. And yes, it's something that we should address. So, you know, assuming that's where we're at, like how would I work with an individual who was dealing with that? First would be, I guess, probably even more awareness to some extent. And so that might include, like you said, naming it, but separating that voice and kind of being like, okay, let's pay attention to it. When does it pop up? Like pay attention to it over the week. Do you notice it a lot? Do you not notice it that much? Do you notice it in certain moments? How does it affect you? How does it not affect you? Like, you know, and then at that point, being able to name it helps us notice it, right? So having this critical voice, maybe I notice it in certain times, but once I say like, oh, that's Judge Judy, you know, like, okay, now I'm probably more aware of it. Or when it pops up, I'm like, oh, like that's what that is. Or like, oh, I can recognize that. And so, you know, that aspect of naming, paying attention to, that's probably going to be the first step. Mm-hmm. Second step is probably going to look something like seeing if it's amenable to stepping aside or to being replaced. And so what I mean by that is, you know, you talked about the volume knobs and how you've used the volume knobs and that's been helpful for you. You can turn down Judge Judy, you can turn up Ted Lasso. That's very helpful. And like Judy and Ted seem to be amenable to that. And so like they're, you know, Judge Judy's comfortable stepping aside and it's like, you can shift your inner experience in that way. You know, and that would probably be my first step with an athlete is, can we find a different part that's more comfortable to embody or that's going to help you more? And can you kind of lock into that instead of locking into this alternative and like kind of turn down that alternative and transition to this? And so that usually if I'm working with an athlete there, like we're talking about ahead of time, what's this person's strengths? How do they take those strengths and turn them into effectiveness in their given sport? Mm-hmm. And we're building some sort of sense of identity around that. Identity is important because it almost becomes like its own part. The way I see myself mm-hmm. changes the way that I pay attention to things and what I foreground and background and what I'm looking for. And so that sense of identity for me, like I use it constantly because it just plays such a huge role in creating focus and confidence and consistency, which are often the things that people are looking for, is so if we can lock in an identity that feels comfortable for them, if it feels real to them, if it feels exciting to them, often there's that ability to turn down sort of this other part and then focus in this other space and focus in on this identity, focus in, let me be this. You know, we've all probably as sports psychology people or just people in the world have heard the thing, like, don't think of a yellow elephant. And the first thing you think of is a yellow elephant. Yeah. Spending too much focus, just turning down one volume knob is problematic, is harder if you're just trying to keep turning this one down. Replacing that and turning up the volume on something else is going to be helpful. And so identity becomes a place you can live, like your identity as an athlete. So someone who I've worked with once was Be the Cannonball and approached his sport. And so, you know, he could turn down the volume and other things, say Be the Cannonball. That meant all sorts of stuff to him about what skills and strengths and moments in the game he should focus on. And so he could live there, and that kind of silenced the other things naturally too. So that's, that would maybe be step two. That's a long step two. And you look like you have a question. So
I do. So to kind of clarify, so it's like, if it's not, like for me, I find it very, like, I guess sometimes like I can control the volume knobs, but you're saying if it's hard to, you first want to identify what your identity is, what your strengths are, and then identify the voice that best, I guess, makes you feel like, and
we're probably leaving self-talk at this point a little bit and moving towards something else. But that something else also changes our self-talk. So like if I can, you know, having that set of, that sense of identity, or, you know, what am I doing? So let's say, you know, you're talking about giving a workshop or whatever. And as a presenter, like, let's say I'm going in, what are my strengths as a presenter? What do I do well? How do I want to deliver this workshop? Like, whatever it is. Right. And so having this identity of like, oh, I'm really good at explaining things, or I come up with really fun activities. So let me foreground this activities. And my goal here is really to just let me get people engaged in the activities, or let me get people having fun, or let me, maybe I present things emotionally. And it's like, great, let me get people emotionally. Maybe you're whatever, like you design the workshop that way. These questions start to come up, being able to focus yourself on a task of like, okay, I can turn down the critic. Mm-hmm. I just have to present emotionally, or I have to have people have fun, right? Like that can simplify things and feel doable and change a lot for us. It's not necessarily self-talk. It's more of like, I can change my challenge at a certain time so that it becomes focusing and confidence building, as opposed to just listening.
Got you.
To duty. Kind of what I'm saying there is we leave self-talk a little bit. It's not necessarily a new voice, but that those strengths and identity do become a focal point.
Got you. It's more of shifting the focus rather than... That's fascinating. I just lost my train of thought, but I think where I was going to go to next, it's like you've identified whether this voice helps or not, whether you can turn down the volume knobs or not. And again, this is a little bit, like you said, already going off of self-talk, but it brings me to the point of like alter egos. That's something I've been reading a lot. My favorite athlete of all time is Kobe Bryant, and I just bought like his book, The Mamba Mentality. And a lot of what he talks about is like when he's out on the court, the way he acts and talks to himself and thinks through things is different. Like that's not Kobe, that's Mamba. David Goggins talks about it the same way, where like when he goes into a situation that's tough, the way he's acting is not David Goggins, it's Goggins. And his self-talk and the things he focuses on changes a lot too. And self-talk almost becomes not the focus, but a tool to go back and forth between the two. So he described a situation where he was on like a 100-mile run, and a certain point of the way through it, he was just completely tattered. You know, I think he broken some of his toes, you know, was pissing blood and all these things. And he was like, dude, just give up. This is not it. But then using self-talk, he switched. He's like, there's this voice that just said like, what if? What if I did this? And then what if I became this person that, you know, I want to be? And he focused on his strengths of like pushing through. And I'm guess, am I hitting on something there with self-talk almost being that?
You absolutely are. And I think like we start to get into this area where strictly speaking, if you're working with someone, is this like a self-talk intervention? I don't know. Doesn't matter that much. Probably not.
Yeah.
What we do get into here is like how parts and voices and multiplicity of self, right? Mm-hmm. Multiplicity of self, I bumped into as an internal family systems term to describe, rather than a unitary self, I am Kobe Bryant. A multiplicity of self is I am Kobe Bryant and I'm Mamba. If it's, you know, I'm David Goggins and I'm Goggins, right? Is there's these two different ways that I can be at these different times. And in certain moments, I can lean on these alternative ways of being and these alternative ways of seeing myself to interact with the world in different ways and draw on different strengths and capabilities. Maybe as Kobe Bryant, I can't do blank, but as Mamba, I can. Maybe as David Goggins, I can't get through that 100-mile run. Maybe I'm going to quit, but as Goggins, I can. You know, and so, you know, we do get into this same idea of our self-talk is dialogical because of normal human multiplicity of self. We have more than one way of interacting with and thinking about the world. If you've ever had an argument with yourself, right, that doesn't necessarily feel like being two different people, but it does feel like having two different opinions. And probably what part of that is also just how committed are you to embodying that at a certain time? There's probably some individual human difference on, you know, how does this really feel and appear at a different time? To some extent, is it a little bit pretend? Sure. But also in a different way, it's totally real because having this alternative identity comes with what I talked about before, right? It's going to come with a different narrative of self and a different view of self. So a different identity. That's going to mean we foreground different characteristics that we have and background different characteristics that we have. Now I'm Goggins instead of David Goggins. Maybe I'm foregrounding determination and strength and pushing through and toughness and backgrounding doubts and questions and other things, right? And so I switched that. And, you know, that's also going to change how we interpret what we're interacting with in the world. That's going to change, like, how confident we feel in that moment. So similar to that fight or flight piece before, or that, you know, inner critic, there's an organization of our brains and bodies that comes with seeing ourselves in a certain way. There's probably an organization of the brain and body and body systems that comes with being Goggins versus David Goggins, you know, that why not? And I think that can be true. So like when I encourage an athlete to be the cannonball or have this cue word that comes with a whole identity, it's different from just cueing attention. It is in part encouraging them to connect with this identity because, that identity can become so all-encompassing and do so much of the work. Yeah. David Goggins doesn't have to say to himself there, okay, be positive, be tough, keep pushing, you know, keep focusing on the good stuff and backgrounding the bad stuff. Like keep, you know, whatever, right? Mm-hmm. Like he just has to say, be Goggins, time to be Goggins or whatever, however he cues that. And then that identity sort of does the work for him.
Yeah.
And there's, you know, this starts to look at, you know, multiplicity of the self and maybe dynamic systems theories a little bit and how like these different selves or these different alter egos or whatever we want to call them kind of become their own steady states that we work from. It starts to pull in some gestalt psychology too. And, you know, how our wants and needs at a certain moment interact with the world and help us organize our environment perceptually. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, within all of that, I do think there's actually some really, really cool questions we could ask and progress that could be made in sports psychology around, you know, can we harness that in certain ways? Because some people already have, right? Like you just referenced two people who clearly have found ways to harness that already.
Yeah, I think that is definitely going to be something fascinating for sports psychology to turn to, because like we describe all these mental skills like confidence and, you know, self-talk and visualization, etc. I think this idea of like tapping into an identity and the alter ego, I guess, is going to be fast, because some of the best athletes in the world have done it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Mike Tyson has one, and I think actors do a really good job of this. And this is probably getting into a little outside of sports, but like high performing actors, right? Like Joaquin Phoenix being the Joker, or just some of the other, like I think Marlon Brando, or some of the actors that are known very much like do method acting where they embody the character off and on screen, like Jim Carrey, I think when he was playing, I forget who he was playing in one of the movies, but like on the set and off the set, he was that character. And it changed the way he went about things because he just had to be this person. He had to be the Joker. And I think that's cool because maybe there's a way where people can identify within themselves what they would want to be.
Mm-hmm.
And so when you're working with these athletes, right, is there like journal prompts or something actionable that you have them do to identify some of these things?
I wouldn't say typically a journal prompt, like a specific journal prompt. Like I have people journal from time to time. Often, you know, it kind of starts with focusing on strengths and focusing sort of just on moments of, you know, when do you feel joy or connected with the sport? When do you feel good about it? Because I take the emotions of joy or, you know, a recognition of strengths to be important gateways to flow state. And so like, it's going to, those are easy things to recognize, but also without getting too in the weeds, like it starts to tell us like, how do you naturally connect with your sport?
Yeah.
And that's kind of where we want to head. And then through that conversation over time, you know, then we start to look at, you know, how do those strengths and moments of joy and some of your characteristics as a person come together to give you an identity, and what does that identity look like? And so, you know, I used to do this more where I, you know, with a team would encourage them to think about, you know, if you had like a character from a movie or a comic book or a show or whatever that like embodied your game, who would it be and why? Right. And like, you'd get some interesting answers. You'd get the Captain Americas, you'd get the this, you'd get the that. Like, it was funny. Like there's a team I was working with at one point where I'd worked with them for a little bit, but I was still definitely trying to like earn some respect there. And so like mine would be, if I was still playing any sort of sport at all, Dumbledore from Harry Potter. Ooh. You know, that would 100% be, that's what I want my game to look like. Right. It's like, there's some calmness and casualness about it, but then there's also like wisdom and intensity, right? Like it's thinking first. There's a lot going on behind the scenes, even though he doesn't look like he's working hard. But then if you are a Harry Potter nerd, as I might be secretly, right, he's also the most powerful wizard there is. And so, you know, that's what we're looking for here, right? Is like, it does trigger some power and strength and that sort of thing. The coach thought I said Dumbo, like the elephant with big ears. He was not a Harry Potter fan. So he was like, why does this guy want to be Dumbo? anyway, the workshop went better with the team than it did in my explanation to the coach. And so people pick things, right? And
that's cool.
And pull from those. And so that might be a kind of exercise that I do use to help someone start thinking about what resonates with me. And it's important that this isn't just about, you know, I'm Captain America because I want to be strong, right? Mm-hmm. Like one of the people who picked Captain America was about, you know, he's one of the team, but also feels like he's trying to do a lot for a lot of people and spreads himself sort of thin, which I don't know if that's in the plot of Captain America at all. I've never actually seen that myself, but it's like, that's part of what he resonated with, is trying to be a lot for a lot of people, which sometimes can be a good characteristic. Sometimes it's challenging, allows us to explore that more. But then also in a game, it means something to him, like be Captain America, like you said, it's be Goggins, it's be this. And so those things come up and become kind of self-organizing, if that makes sense, is like just by cueing ourselves to be that, it puts us into a certain state. And, you know, you talked about historically sports psychology is using some combination of self-talk and imagery and pregame routine and visualizing routine to try to facilitate this state that might bring us closer to flow. Whereas if you can have a strength or power, but also highlights on a technical, tactical sort of aspect, what should I be paying attention to? What is my challenge? Right. And so flow, if you look at that graph, it's challenge versus skill, like perceived challenge versus perceived skill. Well, if I'm cueing Captain America, I'm also cueing for myself a certain set of challenges. and a certain amount of skill. And so what that's going to do is put me at a certain place there. And so, you know, like with that athlete I worked with who is Be the Cannonball, right? The Cannonball has some identity features to it. Cannonballs are strong and powerful. They go fast. They're explosive. They're one direction. Not a lot of things get in their way. Or if they do, that's trouble for those things. Mm-hmm. Parts of what that cued for him are, can I explode into space? Can I be really direct? Can I use my speed and size really aggressively? Those challenges are baked in. That's part of what that means to him. And so in addition to cueing feelings, it's also cueing a task, and that task happens to be something he's comfortable and confident in, but also specific. So we're getting into ideally some sort of flow state kind of thing there. I'm like drawing the graph with my hand. Yeah. People can't see that and as they're listening, but that's part of it.
Oh, that is so cool. A part of like, I'm not like, I'm in a way speechless because that is so sick. It's not just like this thing that people say, oh yeah, I'm alter ego. And like, there's a lot of psych and science behind it. And I would like to research into this as I get more and more into my own, you know, story as a researcher and as a academic. And also I didn't even realize we're already at 55 minutes because time flies when you're having fun. But I guess, absolutely. We've identified some of these steps. I guess, do you want to finish that loop? Like, does it end once you identify these characteristics or when you find these volume knobs, or are there other steps after it?
Well, I think, and knowing that we're pressed for time here, like, there's also something that's important, which is that it's not always that simple to get the very self-critical parts to step aside. So it's not always as simple as, hey, can you turn down a volume knob? Or it's not always as simple as like, hey, what's this alter ego or identity that we can tap into that facilitates a lot of these other things. You know, sometimes you're going to have these very powerful inner critics that are shaped by really difficult experiences. This is something, to be honest with you, you know, having bumped into this in more challenging ways, probably in therapy than on the sports side of thing, but also with some athletes, you know, it's part of why I've turned more to emotion-focused therapies and family systems therapies. Which really have, I think, more to say about why some of these parts or why some of these ways of organizing ourselves become so sticky. And so, you know, internal family systems really talks about, and I think this is super important because mm-hmm. sometimes we have these parts or we have these patterns or we have these tendencies, and we can get so frustrated with ourselves for falling into these patterns regularly. And, you know, you can look around and it can feel like, well, it should be so easy. It should be voices and volume knobs. It should be changing my self-talk. It should be imagining something different, but why don't I feel confident yet? Like, why do I still feel afraid? Why do I still feel critical of myself? And so what internal family systems is going to really talk about is that, you know, that part of you develops in reaction to something you've been through and might play a protective role. And rather than working really hard to push against that and fight that, because it's a part of ourselves, what's important is to integrate it and to understand it and treat it with compassion. Which is also part of why I like the four-year-olds thing, because we tend to be more compassionate with four-year-olds than adults. And so it's like, you have this part of you that's being really hard on you. Can you understand why? Can you understand where it came from? Can you understand what it thinks it's doing? More likely than not, that part of you that's so hard on you is going to think it's helping you in some sort of way. And being able to open up, you know, that part and see, well, what does it want and need from me? Or what does it want and need to feel comfortable stepping aside? What does it need to understand that maybe it doesn't right now? You know, those are important things. And, you know, things I certainly haven't mastered or don't have clear answers on yet. But I know within internal family systems, you know, that's a big part of what the work is how do we help these different parts feel comfortable stepping aside, even though they think they might have a really important role, in order to maybe let our best shine through or give us a little bit more space to have some agency. And so that's really important, is like, for people listening, if you can't just get these to step aside by turning down a mental volume knob, there's probably some work to do there. It's not that there's something wrong with you. It's not that you're not trying hard enough. It's that that part probably thinks it's doing something really important that might be in proportion to pain or struggle that you've been through in the past. Mm-hmm. And so being attentive to that part is being protected, or this part of you that has struggled, or, you know, what that part thinks is protecting you from, is probably an important part of that process.
Oh, I think that's really cool, because I think it puts a different perspective on things like emotions, like anxiety, where instead of something to get rid of, it's kind of like accepting it for what it is. And I think that's where mindfulness also becomes a part of it. It's like, what is this serving me, and why is it there? What is it bringing to my attention? Where the voice is telling you I'm not good enough, it's not like, all right, let's shove it aside. It's like, well, maybe it's trying to tell me, like, hey, the effort you're putting in right now might not be enough to get you where you need to be. And it's just doing it in a really harsh way. And, you know, I guess that's where working with a therapist, or I guess,
you know, it also could be because
go ahead.
Yeah, no, sorry. My screen froze for a second, so I didn't realize I was cutting across you. But, you know, I think in that example there, like, the inner critic might be trying to protect you from failure, right? Yeah. As it sees all the places where it thinks you could be better. And it, maybe what it would say, well, what's your job? Like, what its reaction would be is like, well, if you're not so hard on yourself, then you're going to fail, or you're going to miss details. You know, you tend to screw things up. So if you're not hard on yourself all the time, you're going to be lazy. Like, maybe those are things that pop up. And, you know, at that point, you know, maybe you have hurt in the past about not paying attention to details, or feeling lazy, or feeling not good enough, right? That's what it's trying to protect you from. And so, you know, being able to make some peace there and work through that. Yeah. Like, certainly there's a therapy component to this, and like internal family systems is a therapy approach, like a psychotherapy approach. But I think there's also a lot of room in sports psychology and in the realm of self-talk too, to be able to recognize there's different voices here and they're playing different roles. Veep is a great metaphor, right? It's like, everyone on that team is, I think, I don't know the show, but everyone on that team's trying their best to help.
Yeah.
And so inside your head too, all of these different parts are trying their best to help. And, you know, with something like anxiety, anxiety is uncomfortable. So we'd like it to go away, but we have to work with it to help it feel comfortable going away. The part of you that's afraid needs support more than it needs to be punished.
Yeah.
And that's kind of the direction that hopefully a lot of this work heads. And I think it's, you know, maybe historically, like, a lot of our self-talk interventions were just heavily focused on thought stopping, or positive versus negative, or, you know, keywords, which I still think are really good, but it would be interesting. And I think maybe capture what I think isn't, like, you know, in internal family systems, they call it the normal multiplicity of the human mind. And it's like, I think having an approach to self-talk in sport, which draws on what is a normal multiplicity of the human mind, probably more accurately relates to our experience and gives us more compassionate ways of interacting with ourselves and, you know, managing parts that block us or negatively affect us, or helping parts that are going to boost us or help us perform better or whatever. And so I think that's a really promising direction.
That's cool. I keep drawing, like, analogies with TV shows and movies, because sometimes that is how I think, and I notice patterns a lot. But have you seen the movie Inside Out?
Yes, I have. I haven't seen the second one yet, though, which I think recently came out.
Because, I mean, that's where, like, it gives voices to emotions rather than, like, just thoughts. But it does a really good job in painting, like, in the first movie, like, sadness was something to be avoided. But in reality, it serves a very big purpose to allow us to feel our emotions, and being okay with it is something that Joy had to learn in the movie. I think you will really, really, really enjoy this. The second one blew my mind, because it's right around the time when I'm learning about self-talk and sports. And that's a lot of what the movie's about. It's all these voices in her heads when she's at a training camp for hockey.
Mm.
And the main character, or I guess the antagonist, is anxiety and the role that it plays in her head. And, like, I won't spoil it, because I really do think you would enjoy watching the movie. But a lot of what you said, and acceptance, and being, seeing what role anxiety serves, and it's not always bad, was the takeaway in the movie.
Yeah, I think using Inside Out for people who have seen it as a way to consider sort of multiplicity of the mind is something I've done, though I haven't seen the second one yet. So now I'm looking forward to it. I didn't realize there was hockey in it, which is a sport I work with a lot. So that's great. I can use that with a lot of hockey players, probably.
I mentioned, like, when we're talking about the voices in the workshop, and they named, like, Bob the Builder and Wreck-It Ralph as the other character that brings you down in their self-talk. I brought up Inside Out, and a lot of them, oh my God, I love that movie. Can we watch clips of it? So yeah. I think next lesson, I'm going to bring in a little projector and we're going to go through like, this is what anxiety did and what does it look like? Mm-hmm. Because I think it's brilliant that Pixar made a movie like that, because yeah. there is a lot of thing with anxiety going around because of social media and whatever the reasons might be. But I think people need to start learning to see like it does serve a purpose, and sometimes it's negative, but can't just get rid of it or push right. it down. It's just going to bubble up under the surface, the yellow elephant example that you gave. So it's cool to see that this is getting more and more attention, and it's awesome that this will hopefully
yeah, I bring think
the self-talk.
Yeah, absolutely. I think like that sounds like it draws a lot on emotion-focused therapy and the way the emotions are viewed there, and internal family systems, and just, you know, being compassionate with yourself, which as much as high performance is about things like discipline and working hard and pushing yourself, having some of that self-compassion and being kind to yourself and, you know, also is really important. And, you know, that's often what I'm spending more time working with people I work with and performers I work with on. Isn't, they're already hard enough on themselves. That's not the issue. You know, the issue is that the other side and developing that compassion. And yeah, that's yeah. cool. I'll have to watch Inside Out too.
I look forward to hearing about it. So now that we're nearing the end, I always like to do like a rapid fire, like three questions down the
episode.
All right. And like, so in like in 2 to 3 sentences, we have three questions. So the first one is, knowing what you know about self-talk, what is one piece of advice you'd give to your younger self? Deep question, right?
Yeah, no. Wax me with that one. No, that's good. I was a hothead. I struggled a lot. I was a hockey player, and it masks the intensity of that sport, masks a lot of probably anger issues. And 2 to 3 sentences, what would I say to him? I've never said anything in my life in 2 to 3 sentences, so that's the hold up here. But I think probably, you know, something along
the lines. I'll give you that. Yeah,
I would probably say, probably just try to emphasize something about vulnerability, and maybe it's not so much about self talk, but like it's okay to recognize that you might feel embarrassed or bad or hurt or sad, or you know, like a lot of my anger was about difficulty probably with those emotions, and so it's not so much a self talk thing. Mm-hmm. But, you know, maybe if I was focusing it on self-talk, you know, if you weren't beating yourself up, what would you be feeling or what would be going on for you, and go from there.
That's awesome. Second question is, what is one book that has changed the way you view yourself?
I mean, recently this Internal Family Systems book, which is called Introduction to Internal Family Systems by Rob Schwartz, super accessible. It's not like a therapist book, although I'm a therapist and I read it. So like you can, but that's a really good one. One of my favorites though is Peak, which is the book on deliberate practice.
Mm-hmm.
I love that book. Like, I just think like there's so much in there that's so cool, and you can really tap into, you know, a way of improving at things and getting better at things. Like, I just think that's such a cool book. So that,
yeah,
you know, we'll throw both of those out there.
Perfect. And then last one. So this doesn't have to relate to self-talk, but I'm curious, what is one skill that listeners can work on to improve their lives and become high performers?
Mm-hmm. Deliberate practice would be one, but honestly, like I think if there's a skill that could help you improve your life, or that I know has helped me improve my life, it really like emotional intelligence, and not just like being able to recognize feelings in yourself and other people, but just, you know, maybe even emotional sensitivity as opposed to emotional intelligence, is like being able to recognize what you're feeling, make space for what you're feeling, be responsive to what you're feeling. How's that for a very therapist-y answer? But that's what I would say. And I mean, on the performance side of things, I still think that's really important. Emotions are a part of performance. So, yeah, there you go.
That's perfect. Well, this brings us to the end. Thank you so much, Dr. Andrew, for coming in, speaking with me, and speaking with our viewers. And I'm sure we'll definitely have to have you on again sometime, just because a lot of what we're talking about already opens up avenues and doors to many other topics that I think we'd have fun. Yeah. But this is incredibly helpful. I guess where can listeners find out more about you, or if they're interested in meeting with you or speaking with you?
I got to be honest, like I don't have any social media or anything like that. So I do have a website for my practice, which like will give you fairly limited information. It's vincentpsychology.com. So you can check it out there. My contact information is on there. So like my email and then like my practice phone number. But unfortunately there's really like, there's no social media otherwise for getting in touch. So yeah, that's where you can start.
Perfect. And I think it's good that you don't have social media. Sometimes, well, it can be a lot.
I'm just resistant to change. And so I never picked it up in the first place.
We'll end it there. Thank you so much once again. And I hope you have a wonderful rest of your day.
You too. Thank you very much for having me.